This is Marvin Curtis, your host for Lift Every Voice, celebrating the African-American spirit here on WUBS, sponsored by the South Bend Symphony Orchestra. Stay with us for the 10-week series on the life and love and creation of African-American music in America.
Talked about shows you born.
This is Marvin Curtis, your host for Lift Every Voice, celebrating the African-American spirit here on WUBS 89.7 FM. This program is sponsored by the South Bend Symphony Orchestra. Today's program is about a wonderful piece of music called Lift Every Voice and Sing. We know it as the Negro National Anthem or the Black National Anthem. And the history of this anthem is very important because it falls in the time frame right after the end of slavery and Reconstruction. The authors of this piece were James Weldon Johnson and his brother J. Rosamond Johnson. And their history is very important, something that most of us don't know much about because it's not part of our history of school. So, a little bit about James Weldon and his brother. James Weldon Johnson's father was named James Johnson. He was an African-American freeman born in Richmond, Virginia in 1830. His mother was Helen Louise Diller, of Haitian descent, born in Nassau, Bahamas in 1842. Helen attended the New York Public School for Colored Children and had a great vocal talent. Between her 18th and 19th birthday, she sang a concert, and James Johnson was in the audience, living in New York. Their romance began during the time of the Civil War. Helen's mother, hearing a rumor that if the South won the war, all Northern black people would become slaves, became frightened and moved her family back to Nassau, Bahamas. However, in the true love story, James Johnson followed in search of Helen, gained employment at the Royal Victoria Hotel as head waiter, and they were married on April 22, 1864. They were a middle-class family in the Bahamas. However, in 1866, this great hurricane destroyed much of the island. In 1869, James Johnson decided to return to New York with his wife and infant daughter, Marie Louise. But having talked to a patron at the hotel where he worked, the Royal Victoria Hotel, he heard about a place called Jacksonville, Florida. And he moved there in 1870. Their daughter, unfortunately, passed away during that time period. But in 1871, their son, James Weldon Johnson, was born. And in 1873, their second son, John Rosamond, was born. It was the height of the Reconstruction era. I'm going to fast forward a little bit because so much went on during that time period. But the brothers grew up in a very middle-class household. Their father became head waiter at the prestigious St. James Hotel, and their mother taught at the Stanton School for Colored Children. There was a piano in their home, artwork, and Jacksonville, Florida at that time boasted of African Americans in a position of leadership as police, firefighters, city council members, and even judges. James Weldon Johnson encountered people such as Frederick Douglass, and he graduated from Stanton in 1894 to attend Atlanta University and the opportunity to study medicine on a Harvard scholarship. It was during the summer of his student teaching in a place called rural Hampton, Georgia, that he came face to face with poor African Americans, and it altered his thinking. He wrote in his book, Along This Way, "I was anxious to learn to know the masses of my people, to know what they thought, what they felt, and the things of which they dreaded. And in trying to find out, I laid the first stones in the foundation of faith in them, which I have stood ever since." From this experience of teaching in this rural area, James Weldon Johnson discovered that his idea of becoming a doctor gave way to becoming a teacher. He chose to become an educator as a means of living, not of making a living. Graduated from Atlanta University and returned to Jacksonville as principal of the Stanton School, the school that he had attended where his mother had taught. So he turned down a scholarship to Harvard to go back to Jacksonville, Florida. 2 years later, in 1896, he became the first African-American to pass the Florida bar exam. His brother John attended Boston's New England Conservatory of Music, studying piano, organ, composition, and voice. Working briefly in London with Samuel Coleridge Taylor, he He returned to Jacksonville in 1897, a year later, to appear in a musical review, and became supervisor of music for the Stanton School. In 1899, a group of young men decided to hold a celebration of Lincoln's birthday, which was February 12th, 1900. James Weldon writes this: "I was put down for an address, which I began preparing, but I wanted to do something else. My thoughts began buzzing around a central idea of writing a poem on Lincoln, but I couldn't net them. Therefore, I gave up the project as beyond me, at any rate, beyond me to carry out in a short time, and my poem on Lincoln is still to be written. My central idea, however, took on another form. I talked over with my brother the thought I had in my mind, and we planned to write a song to be sung as a part of the exercises. We planned, better still, to have it sung by the school children, a chorus of 500 voices. I got my first line, 'Lift every voice and sing.' Not a startling line, but I worked along writing out the next five. When near the end of the first stanza, they came to me the lines, 'Sing a song full of the faith that the dark past has taught us. Sing a song full of the hope that the present has brought us.' The spirit of the poem had taken hold of me. I finished the stanza and turned it over to Rosman. In composing the next two stanzas, I did not use pen and paper. While my brother worked at his musical setting, I paced back and forth on the front porch, repeating the lines over and over to myself, going through all the agony and ecstasy of creating. As I worked through the opening and middle lines of the last stanza, 'God of our weary years, God of our silent tears, thou who hast brought us thus far on the way, thou who hast by thy might led us into the light, keep us forever in the path we pray. Lest our feet stray from the places, our God, where we met thee, lest our hearts, drunk with the wine of the world, we forget thee.' I could not keep back the tears and made no effort to do so. I was experiencing the transport of a poet's ecstasy. Firstly, ecstasy was followed by the contentment, that sense of serene joy, which makes artistic creation the most complete of all human experiences." These words from James Weldon Johnson from his book Along This Way. The song was first performed on February 12, 1900 by 500 school children at the Stanton School in Jacksonville, Florida. We're going to hear 577 school children now perform "Lift Every Voice and Sing" in Atlanta, Georgia. These 500 school children are reminiscent of the days of 1900.
See you.
577 voices of Atlanta, Georgia's Children's Choir singing Lift Every Voice and Sing, reminiscent of what happened in the year 1900. James Weldon Johnson and his brother J. Rosamond Johnson did not think of this as the Negro National Anthem. It was called Lift Every Voice and Sing. And so they decided that it was just a nice piece of music and did not see it as a huge thing in the world of African Americans. However, as we know, when black folks hear something they like, they repeat it over and over again. Those 500 children and their grandparents and aunts and uncles continued to sing the song. And pretty soon it was published in 1903 by Mark's Music Company. And before and after that, it appeared in programs and hymn books, pasted inside, and was sung all over the South, basically. There was no national anthem in the year 1900. The Star-Spangled Banner was not given the title of the national anthem until 1931. So for the next 31 years, Lift Every Voice and Sing was out there. John Rosamond Johnson went on to New York, and he and James put together to write operas and try to do other things in music. But the idea of uplifting the race with music that was different than the minstrel show songs at the time. It was James Weldon's idea to use his intellectual and artistic endeavors in the political sphere to counter the popular culture perception of what African Americans look like. Over the time period, it was not until the Negro National Anthem title was given to it performed by the Williams and Walter Glee Club at the National Negro Business Conference hosted by Booker T. Washington. There's a lot about James Weldon Johnson I would love to talk about, but more importantly, I want to talk about the next thing that we're going to listen to, which is the actual concert version that many of us do. Our guest today is Roland Carter, and Roland Carter is one of the great musicians of the world. And in 1970, he arranged Lift Every Voice and Sing for orchestra, actually for piano and then for orchestra, in a concert version. And I had a chance to talk with Roland about his arrangement and what he felt and how he felt about it and why he did it. And we're going to listen to his conversation about that. But first, I want to talk a little bit more about how Lift Every Voice and Sing grew and continued to grow as our Negro National Anthem, now known as the Black National Anthem. It became that song that galvanized people together, that brought black folks together, that gave us hope, that gave us a sense of who we are, and has become a part of our staple life that African Americans and now everyone stands when they hear this particular piece. So from a children's song in 1900, it has become worldwide as an anthem. And here's Roland Carter and I talking about that song. We have a special guest this afternoon. His name is Roland M. Carter. Many of you may know his name and his fame as a choral conductor, a choral arranger, pianist, mentor to many of us in the music world, and the arranger of Lift Every Voice and Sing. And it is a staple in African Americans' universities and colleges, and most of us who do Lift Every Voice and Sing only use Roland's arrangement. So I want to welcome Roland Carter, first of all. Welcome, Roland.
Thank you very much, Marvin. Delighted to be with you.
Thank you. For those of you that don't know Roland's background, I met Roland when he was at Hampton Institute, or Hampton University, in Hampton, Virginia, where he was there for many, many years as choir director. And he left there to go to the University of Tennessee in Chattanooga. Am I correct?
Yeah, came back home after 30 years.
He came back
to head the Department of Music at an institution I couldn't go to when I left to go to Hampton.
That is very interesting that the school that denied you entrance brought you back as the chair of the department, the endowed chair, no less. So there is some progress to be made. Roland is known for his arrangements of many songs, and I've done many of his arrangements. He also is, I think you are still the only African-American that has his own publishing company. Am I right?
Well, I don't think I was the only one. No, many of us self-published. I'm not sure. No, well, you know, the Handy Company was going all along. So there are several companies out there.
But Marvel Music was the one that we used.
Well, and that one now is not going anymore. I my catalog now is being handled by someone else.
Okay. Well, Roland has been my mentor for many, many years. I met him back in 79, and I've been hearing about him for a long time before that. And
you are too kind.
It's true.
I'm so proud to be a friend of yours. I'm delighted by that you refer to me as a mentor. It makes me feel good. It makes me look good. as great as you are.
That's the truth. It's the truth. So tell us a little bit about why you arranged Lift Their Voice and Sing the way that you did.
Well, you must know that I grew up in a very segregated society in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and grew up singing the song every morning in elementary school, along with My Country, 'Tis of Thee, and, stating the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag and the Christian flag. We did that every morning, every day of school, you know, so I had that song embedded in me. Also, I was not a real activist, but I was involved in social movement as my high school class initiated the sit-ins in Chattanooga at my graduating year in 1960, so as we did not have a college as many of the other cities, HBCU, as many of the other cities had to promote the sit-ins. So my high school class took on the bit. So I was involved in that. I was a vice president of the youth NAACP. And of course, you well know that the NAACP gave the designation of the Negro National Anthem,
yes,
having adopted it in 1919,
yes,
as the organization's hymn.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So anyway, I decided to do this in about 1970, I think, was the first performance of my arrangement, which comes out about 52 years ago. Wow, boy, isn't it? And the idea was that as a choir director and a programmer, we always liked to end programs, and I don't know if you did or not, but we would end with something patriotic and big.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided, and we used to do the Wilhowski.
Yes, the Battle Hymn. Yes,
you know,
yes,
that was the big closer in college programs, especially with the HBCUs. So I decided we needed something else in the 70s after the civil rights movement, and during and the Black Power movement, and also the war in the Vietnamese War. My concern was that the song, although had reference somewhat to black and white, but never stated that. And it was more about man's inhumaneness to man. And my concern was that my interest was in having everybody sing about that and the discrepancies that happened to each other, rather than just because it was not a racial issue at all, because the NAACP has always had many, many non-black supporters throughout its history. So that was not an issue. Race was not an issue. It was just the sense of inhumane man's insensitivity to man. So, and at that time, they started publishing it in various hymnals, and so I thought it was time for the song to reach another audience, and that was my goal with that arrangement.
And I can tell you, we've done it with the South Bend Symphony here. We've done it several times for our Martin Luther King programs. I've done it. I did it in Richmond, Virginia. I think we did it in New York. We've done it everywhere. I first heard it in Hampton when I first came to the Hampton Institute. at Hampton Ministers Conference, and it was just amazing. So you took a, it is set in a grand, I'll say a very grand style. The third verse, God of Our Weary Years, is like a prayer. Can you talk a little bit about why you said it that way?
Well, I actually, and I must make everyone aware, I had done the Wilhowsky Bow Hymn of a Republic, and it just so happens that the three verses of Lift Every Voice fit right in with the pattern. The Bow Hymn had been set by Wilhowsky and also by Roy Ringwald.
Right.
So it just fell right into place. And of course, with I always thought of the third verse, knowing James Weldon Johnson, I always interpreted it as what I call the eighth trombone. You know, Johnson wrote the seven trombones, the preacher's poems.
God's trombone.
So this one became the eighth one for me.
Okay.
It was like an old deacon standing up and praying. And to me, God of our weary years, God of our silent years, thou who has brought us thus far on the way. He's still getting God's attention, hasn't said a word. You know, thou who is by thy might led us into the light. And then he comes to this one-line prayer, keep us forever in the path that we pray. So it was ideal for me to take that setting of where Ringwald or Wilhowsky was done with the Bow Hymn, because in the Beauty of the Lilies, that third verse
right.
is set as a chorale also.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it just happened to fit. And I borrowed Wilhowsky's model, including the ostinato section where in the Bow Hymn they say, truth is marching,
right.
truth is marching. And I just said, sing a song, sing a song. It just fell in. I was so fortunate in being able to take that. And often I get accused, and not accused, but I get the call or somebody say, well, I heard your Bow Hymn, but no, it was not Bow Hymn. And then they were referring to Lift Every Voice, so, you know.
I love it.
Because many, many choral directors would know that mm-hmm. relationship there. Mm-hmm. And I'm not ashamed of it. No, at all.
So 52 years ago, you first performed this, and we are doing it everywhere all the time. When you hear other choirs doing it and are in the audience or hear about it, what is your feeling?
Oh, I'm really so happy that it becomes a kind of fulfillment for me that people really are singing it and singing it. I think much with much more meaning than I ever intended. Are making the real meaning of the song, so it's not just a okay, let's sing Lift Every Voice and sing, but if they take the effort to learn this arrangement and focus in on the text, then I think it is accomplishing sincerely what I wanted to get done. And of course, I have to comment on the performance in about 2 years ago, 2017, I guess. Oh, that's longer than that, isn't it?
Yeah,
wow.
That's 5 years
with the Mormon Tabernacle Choir.
Oh, wow.
And okay. Which I think the NAACP had a meeting in Salt Lake City at that time. And so they did my arrangement in one of their spoken word programs.
Okay.
And I was just so honored to have that done. That really said, well, boy, you accomplish your goal. You know, you got the world singing.
Yeah.
And then on the internet the other day, I had not realized that so many African choirs had even performed it. I mean, there are six or seven performances by choirs from Africa of the anthem. So I mean, really, I'm very honored, and I for where it has gone.
Well, I can tell you as a choral director and as somebody that has done that piece so many times, it's always an experience that I love, and my students, wherever I am, and even my community choir, we've always sung it, and it does something for me, and for them as well. So we appreciate your arrangement as I call it the seminal arrangement. There's only one arrangement of Literary Voice and Sing that you do with orchestra, and it's Roland Carter's. Yeah, but it is a staple in African-American colleges and many schools. That is the only version, because it is one of the it's the best version. So we appreciate what you did.
Oh, you're very kind. Thank you so very, very much.
Yes. We've been speaking with Roland Carter. He's now retired, distinguished professor of music from the University of Tennessee, Chattanooga, as well as the former professor of music and choir director at Hampton University, and the arranger of Let Every Voice and Sing, the orchestral version, which we're going to hear very shortly, by the 105 Voice Choir of HBCUs at the Kennedy Center. Roland, we thank you very much for being here with us today. And
thank you, Marvin.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
See you soon.
Okay.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
listening to the 105 Voice HBCU Choir at Kennedy Center performing Roland Carter's arrangement, A Little Every Voice and Sing. This is Marvin Yeer Curtis, your host for Little Every Voice, celebrating the African-American spirit here at WUBS, sponsored by the South Bend Symphony Orchestra. Thank you for listening. We hope you learned something this afternoon, and go out and sing, Lift Every Voice and Sing.